You are listening to CITR 101.9 FM at the University of British Columbia Point Grey Campus in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada, located on the traditional ancestral unceded territory of the Musqueam people. Welcome to the Lisa Lafferty Podcast, an exploration into the world of theater through a series of conversations with a talented and eclectic group of accomplished playwrights and theater artists from New York, Vancouver, Montreal, Toronto, London, England, and Saskatoon. Episode 6. Yvette Nolan of Saskatoon is a theater creator who has contributed greatly to the development of Aboriginal theater in Canada. Lisa Lafferty and Yvette Nolan.
I don't even know how to start. It's been a while since I've done one, but okay. Welcome to today's podcast. I'm going to start with a land acknowledgement. The University of British Columbia Point Grey Campus is located on the traditional and ancestral unceded territory of the Musqueam people. And as a theater artist, I am grateful to work, learn, and play here. And I just wanted to add to the land acknowledgement today that we've had a reconciliation pole on the weekend was raised at UBC, carved by James Hart. And in the studio today, welcome Yvette Nolan.
Thank you very much for having me.
A fabulous playwright and Canadian. Now, usually I start the podcast with, we'll talk about you and we'll talk about the topic of the podcast and some other things along the way. But I just want to talk to you for a second about the land acknowledgement. A few months ago, I was noticing in the First Nations Learning House newsletter, it's called The Talking Stick, that they called for volunteers for a task force for the formalizing the Musqueam land acknowledgement here at UBC. And so I wrote to a couple of friends and asked for some advice, and I got some great advice. And so I'm just going to ask you, Yvette, what do you think of land acknowledgements?
On the one hand, I think it's fantastic that we're finally actually Canadians are starting to be forced to recognize the people who were here before them. And on the other hand, I worry about formalizing anything. Too many events I'm at, someone walks out and they're like, so I'm supposed to acknowledge the, like in Toronto, it's the Mississauga of New Credit, right? It's the Mississauga of New Credit. Okay, so getting on with our business, like I think like everything, we have to be mindful about, I would rather have someone come out and just recognize the connection to the land than read off a card, you know, the Musqueam, the Tsleil-Waututh, the Squamish Nations, and be done with it. I actually want Canadians to understand their connection to the land. It is complicated. I mean, I belong to the Indigenous Performing Arts Alliance in Canada, and we've been working on land acknowledgement for a long time to give mainstream theaters and our colleagues a way to understand what it is they're doing. First of all, to acknowledge that they're on the territories of the people, and secondly, to do it in a meaningful way.
So what would your advice be to me as I go to volunteer for this task force?
You know, the advice is always, my mother told a story about being in a circle with an elder who was doing a bunch of teaching, and he would do some teaching and he would ask a question and people would say, he'd say, what do you think that means? And someone would say this and someone would say that. And then he'd get to this one woman and she'd say, I don't know. So he'd do some more teaching and he'd do some more teaching and he would say, what do you think that means? And people would go, I think it means this, I think it means that. And he'd get to the woman and she'd say, I don't know. So he'd do some more teaching and he'd say, what do you think that means? And people would say, I think it means that and I think it means this. And he gets to this woman and she goes, I don't know. And the elder says, try to know. That's what it feels like to me. Try to know. It's like educate yourself. Like it, just be open to all of the education, all of the resources we have there. And there's no one right answer. One of the things I've learned from one of my elders, Maria Campbell, is that we hold knowledge in community, in circles. Everybody in the circle has some of the knowledge. And when we have an elder or elders in the circle, it's not because they have all the answers. They're just holding the circle and they're holding some of the knowledge. And then they're holding all of the knowledge that all of the people in the circle have. And so going into land acknowledgement and task force, it's like, try to know. Hold all of the knowledge that people bring because everybody's teachings are different. And, you know, I'm a stranger here. I'm Algonquin. So my people are from Quebec. my res's Kitigansi being Quebec. I'm grateful to be here on these territories, on Musqueam land here. But when I started work on the first day at the Arts Club, I acknowledged the nations. Nobody else seemed to be willing to do it in the room, and I was like, okay, Vetnadishnikas, Kitigansi be no Nanjaba, Mifat, I'm, you know, Algonquin First Nation from Kitigansi be, and I'm happy to be here on, you know, the territories of the Musqueam, the Salish, the Tsleil-Waututh people. I'm a stranger here, and I'm very glad to be working and playing here, right? So I don't do it like a formal land acknowledgement, but I always work to know who was here before me.
That was the advice that I, similar to the advice that I got from David Geary, our mutual acquaintance, wrote me a nice little letter back when I asked him, and he thought it should be inclusive of more like a newsletter. So that's why I included in mine the reconciliation poll that was erected over the weekend. I think that sounds like a good idea. Including the current news, what's happening, what's going on, sounded like a great addition. And something formal doesn't feel right.
Right.
Now, Yvette, you're here because you're a playwright and a director, a theater artist, as am I, and the topic of the podcast. And the question I usually start with is, what do you do and why?
What do I do? I'm a theater rat. So mostly I do theater, almost anything in the theater. I am a playwright. I am also a director. I'm here in Vancouver directing at the Arts Club. I'm also a dramaturge. I work with lots of playwrights on their work. Lots of playwrights at different levels. Yeah, sometimes they're absolute beginners, sometimes they're established playwrights. But I'll do almost anything in the theater. I mean, I was in university doing my undergrad, and I got sucked into the Black Hole, which was the name of the theater in the basement of the University of Manitoba. And that was it. By the time I got my undergrad, I was working professionally in theater. But I was stage managing, and I was hanging lights, and I was laying dance floor, and I was building props. Like, I did anything to stay in the theater, which has been a great way to sort of make my way, because it means I've had to do less day jobs, because I can do many things in the theater. I recently wrote a book called Medicine Shows. I ran Native Earth Performing Arts in Toronto for 8 years, which is Canada's oldest professional Indigenous theater. And when I was leaving there, I realized that a lot of the information was in my head. And that's because theater's so ephemeral. And like, I'm like, uh-oh, there's a lot of things in my head that only I know, or that, you know, this community knows, but we're about to be splintered. And so I sat down to write this book to kind of download all of the things that I knew about this particular period of time, this 8 years that I had been at Native Earth and all the things that had happened. And Native theater has been, you know, under-documented and under-chronicled. Women's work has been even less so. Like, Native women's work has been even less, you know, because we had the Thompson era, when Thompson was like the one and only. And then we had the Ian Ross era, when Ian was the one and only. And then we had the Kevin Loring era, where Kevin was the one and only. It's like the mainstream can only see one Indian at a time. and it's usually a man. And so all of the work that happened concurrently with Thompson and Ian and Kevin was largely ignored by the academics. A lot of the work that I had done at Native Earth was women's work. Marie Clements, Tara Bagan, a whole bunch of Turtle Gals Performance Ensemble, a whole bunch of women, Melanie Murray, Phelan Johnson. And in order to not lose that work, I decided to write this book. So I wrote this book called Medicine Shows, which I guess makes me another kind of a theater artist, like dramaturge, director, playwright, and then whatever that is. Theorist, maybe. I'm a literary theorist now.
Well, you're certainly in several of the books that I've had to look at for my dramatic studies and dramatic theories and criticism course. I can never remember the title. With Kirsty Johnson, I found your name several times, so I was so delighted that you were in town and to come to see me. Let's talk about women playwrights. You mentioned a little bit that there's been some growth in your particular community. What do you think about Canadian women playwrights and in general?
It's still shocking to me how underrepresented women playwrights are on the stages of this country. I shouldn't be shocked. That seems to be the way of the world. You know, and recently there was another study. There was the Fraticelli report 100 years ago, and then more recently there was another study about equity in theater, and the numbers had not changed in 30 years. We're still like 17% women and everyone else, and the rest were plays by men. It's shocking that that still has not changed, but you know, the theater that has kept me in theater, the plays that kept me in theater, I remember seeing a production of Judith Thompson's The Crack Walker at the Edmonton Fringe Festival when I was like just a baby playwright, and being so shocked that this was on stage and how moved I was. I couldn't actually move at the end. Of course, the Fringe, they just want you to get out so they can get the next show in. So Judith is a huge hero for me. The things she puts on stage are so brave and true. And then she, of course, has taught a whole generation of playwrights. But it's complicated. There's still so, I mean, I know a lot of women who write plays, but I know so few who actually get to the stage. I mean, I'm directing a play by a woman right now at the Arts Club that was developed and commissioned by the Arts Club, so bravo for that. Dorothy Dietrich is the playwright, and the play is The Piano Teacher. And the two central characters, there's three characters, two of them are women of a certain age, which is the other thing that we run into, right? Like, the parts are not there, so the women, there's not, you know, so the women leave theater, and then it's hard, it gets difficult. It's still shocking to me how few plays by women make it to the major stages. Plays that get produced, Persephone in Saskatoon, where I'm living, is doing art at the beginning of next season, which is, of course, by a woman, but it's not Canadian. It's complicated.
Isn't there three men on stage in that play?
Yes. And if you read the literary criticism about it, it's like, are they really men? Like, they're not like men. They're
that's
talking
true.
About art.
That's very true. So we can talk a little bit more now that the Arts Club Theater's come up a couple of times. Let's talk about Dorothy Dietrich and the journey, just a little bit of what you know of her journey to get that play on stage and what the Silver Commission's project is.
I don't know that much about it because I've been brought into it very late in the process. I knew that Dorothy had been, she had brought this idea to them. They've been in development for a long time. She was in the React series a couple of years ago. There have been workshops all the way along the way. And they commissioned her once they had an idea of what the play was, which is fantastic. But I was not attached to the project. And then I guess when they decided to go ahead with the production, they were trying to match her with a director. I guess she had coffee dates with a number of directors, and they weren't all as successful. And then she and I met one rainy day, and you know, I was passing through town. We met for a coffee, and I just talked about the play and what I saw, and that was it. It was a match. So I came on really late in the process. And again, kudos to the Arts Club for actually doing the work to find a director match. You know, which I remember when the Arts Club produced the premiere of The Unplugging, my play, a few years ago. And I had coffee dates with playwright, with directors too, before they matched me with Lois, and we went ahead sort of as the team. So that's a lovely thing to be, you know, and then I'm like, oh my God, that's two women directors. Again, theater is still so male. Where I live, there are very, very few women who are allowed to direct on the stages there.
So you're generally crediting the Arts Club. Who specifically is up to this matching up?
Well, you know, it's trickled down, I'm sure. Like, Bill is, like, he's built that place. Rachel Deiter is the literary manager there, and she does all of that development work. She sort of shepherds all of the new work, and she does a lot of the matchmaking.
Yes, I was hoping you'd say Rachel, because I know she's instrumental in the development of the playwriting at the Arts Club.
And she's the one who brought the Unplugging, my play, to the Arts Club, gave it to Bill, and he said, so I guess let's do this, eh? And they did, and, you know, bless them for it.
It's a fabulous play, The Unplugging. I reread it the other day. Let's talk a little bit about The Unplugging. Where did the initial idea come from? And then we'll talk a little bit about your changing as a playwright.
When I was leaving Native Earth, and I knew I was leaving because I'd been there for a long time, and I was like, oh, what am I going to do? I've been running a theater company. I don't know if I can still write a play. Because when you're running a theater company, your time is limited. And playwriting takes a lot of space around your head, as you would know. My general manager at the time, Donna Michelle St. Bernard, who was herself a playwright, said, okay, so you should write a play for, you know, the next Wysocka Jack, like something. And I was like, I'm not ready. And she's like, yeah, you better just do it. So I had, Kugler, my mentor, had given me a copy of Two Old Women, which is Velma Wallace's retelling of an Athabascan story of set pre-contact of two old women who in a time of need are banished from their community for being old and grouchy, essentially, for being useless. Instead of dying or freezing to death as they're intended to, they dig down and they have to remember their traditional knowledge in order to survive. And they do. And they survive, and then the community realizes that they are not useless, and they come back to them and they ask them to rejoin the community. That idea, I'd read that book many years before, and that idea had stuck with me and stuck with me, and I was like becoming a woman of a certain age, becoming invisible as one does at a certain age, and becoming useless because, you know, I don't have children, like biological children. And what is our value as women in the world once we're no longer producing issue? And I thought, okay, this is something that I can work with. So I took I took essentially the story and I moved it into the 21st century. And these two old women are not actually, I mean, they're my age. They're women of a certain age. So they're 50s and the older one's probably 60. And they're banished from their, you know, it's post-apocalyptic. The lights have gone out. The unplugging refers to the fact that the lights have gone out and never come back on, and the world has kind of collapsed accordingly and then realigned itself behind feudal lords and stuff. These two old women, I'm making the air quote sign, are banished from this community, and they too have to remember what they know in order to survive. And so they do. And then, as in Velma's retelling of the story, the community sends a young man to see what he can learn from them. It is a very much a post-apocalyptic story and a 21st century story because I really am an apocalyptist. I don't actually believe in this world. I don't think we can go on like this. I think we're headed for some kind of ending. And the only way that I could see us going forward was by erasing kind of most of the world and starting over with, you know, a very small community, like these two women and this young man.
Well, it's a beautiful play, and it's quite, you know, it sounds like you're talking about huge issues, and they are huge issues, but the play is very accessible. It's sparsely written, not too much dense dialogue, and moves along very quickly in a really beautiful story with clear relationships and really deep, beautiful characters. I love that play. So your first play, Blade, mm-hmm. right, was at the Winnipeg Fringe Festival in 1990, mm-hmm. and you've written several plays since then. I read Job's Wife or the
Delivery of Grace,
mm-hmm. and recently, which is also a fabulous play. I love in one of your articles that you wrote, you talk about the type of Indian we're allowed to expect or we expect in certain plays. And you draw a parallel with Shakespeare. The funny wise Indian is like the jester in a Shakespeare play. And I find Coyote is like that too. The animal spirits. I just read Jessica as well, by Linda Griffiths and Maria Campbell, and lots of animal spirits, switching characters, speaking chorally, exchanging in and out. How do you think your plays have developed since that first play in 1990?
Wow, that's such a great question. It is such a journey, isn't it? Like my first play actually came to Women in View Festival here, mm-hmm. after the Winnipeg Fringe, and I caught hell from the audience because the central character in Blade is a young white woman who is telling the story. And that's because I'm like an invisible Aboriginal woman. Like I have my father's white skin, my mother's Aboriginal heart. And so that my first engagement with the world is as a woman, like the way the world sees me. And so I was given hell by like, oh, don't you feel the responsibility to be the voice of your people? And I was like, women are my people. but it made me think about like like what that means, like what it, and Blade was not absent of indigenous content. I mean, the reason that character is white is because nobody has been paying attention to the indigenous story until the white woman is killed. And then suddenly they care that someone is killing women because it's not just another Indian, right? And in fact, when Da Vinci's Inquest started a few years later, my mother was all excited. She's like, they're doing Blade. Did you see Da Vinci's Inquest? They're doing Blade. I'm like, yeah, Mom, it's not really – not a new story. That one is not a new story. But that was – it did sort of bring me up short in terms of what stories I wanted to tell and how I wanted to tell them. And then in Job's Wife, I took it to the other extreme and, you know, a young woman asks for help from God. She's a young white woman carrying a child who would be a half-breed like me. And the God that shows up is an Indian. And so she's like, you know, it's one of those, you know, for a while I grappled with cosmology in my early plays. And then, you know, coming along, like I think about now, the unplugging, the indigenous worldview is so entrenched in the script. Like, in as you say, it's a very spare play, and there's no sort of trickster care. Okay, so the other major play in that continuum is Annie Mae's Movement, mm-hmm. about Anna Mae Aquash, who went to the States to work with the American Indian Movement. And there, the Rougarou is right in there. Like, the spirit, that spiritual sort of, I'm making the air quote sign, trickster character, that sort of spiritual guide is in there, moving the action along. And I think that's when I started allowing that kind of the cosmology to actually manifest on stage in that way. There's another, I did an adaptation a few years ago commissioned by the Gateway called The Birds, which is an adaptation of Aristophanes, The Birds, not the Hitchcock, The Birds, but Aristophanes. And it was very freeing to have the container of The Birds, and just, you know, I did it with an indigenous worldview, and there you go. All of those, the birds show up and learning, being colonized and learning the bad habits of the colonizer and how do we protect our culture, but all in the guise of the birds. So it's been interesting to see how my own personal cosmology manifests in the plays over the years, because we start from the plays that we see and the plays that we read. And of course, for me, there was no indigenous theater growing up in Winnipeg. The first thing I ever saw was the Rez Sisters, the touring production. And by then I was like 25 years old or something. I was like, oh, we can do this too. Oh my God, right? The Book of Jessica, which you mentioned, was actually so hugely, hugely important to my development, because she allowed all of those realities to live at the same time, all of those creatures, all of those animal spirits to be in the same space as the characters, or to come and go as they please. That was very freeing for me. Also, the Book of Jessica, I think, is the primer for Canadians in terms of how we go forward with Canadians and First Nations working together, because the relationship that they chronicle in the Book of Jessica between Linda Griffiths and Maria Campbell is so problematic and so challenging, but so clear how we misunderstand each other, how we cannot understand each other, that I've given out probably a dozen books of Jessica to people. Every time someone's like, I want to do this project, you know, and bring in the first, I'm like, you should read this. I give them out. The last one I gave was to Michael Green when he was starting the Making Treaty 7 project. And he asked me for advice. And I'm like, let me give you this book. Because no matter what you do, at some point, you're going to run into this moment.
So you've naturally brought us to my next question. You self-identify as a half-breed, and you discuss Judith Thompson, who writes First Nations characters. And I brought out the Book of Jessica because it's Linda Griffiths, a white playwright, writing with Maria Campbell. And my interest as a theater artist and a current MFA playwriting student, I'm interested in what the community is calling for, and that is multiculturalism on our stages. So how do I, as a white woman, write for other cultures?
Oh, you're asking like totally the wrong person, because because I'm always in the weeds on this. Like I write for everybody, and then I just get killed for, like, I realize now. You asked about my career, like the beginning and the end. So in my very first play, I was getting shit for putting a white woman on stage who was holding the story of the indigenous woman who was disappeared by society. And then a couple of years ago, Factory Theater did the third production of The Unplugging. And Nina Lee Aquino, who is a fantastic director, cast, wow, we both just got slaughtered for casting non-Indigenous people in those roles. And Donna Michelle, whom I've referenced before, said, yeah, it's like a post-colonial production for a world that's not ready for it. we're in the throes of identity politics right now. I don't think there's any right way. I think you just have to do, you have to know what your values are, you have to know why you're doing things, and then you have to do them and be prepared to just eat shit. That's pretty much all I can say, because we can't just be writing. I mean, I have never just written my experience. We bring everything to the room. We can't just be writing. If I would never write men, exactly. I write everybody, and then I put everybody on stage, and the people who are the most marginalized, who have been the most oppressed, very often make the best oppressors. Like, we have to be mindful that we don't become the monster that we're fighting.
I'm now already starting to prepare to catch shit. Do you have any experience with your theater or Canadian theater abroad?
When I was at Native Earth, we started reaching out to, or we were reached out to by an Australian Indigenous company called Yuri Yarkin. And we ended up touring with Yuri Yarkin and Tawata Productions, both in Canada and in Australia and Aotearoa, New Zealand. That's a really strong relationship we have with our Maori whanau, our Maori family, Tawata. Most recently, we started a project called Waka Chiman, means canoe in Te Reo Maori, and Chiman in my language means canoe, because the thing that connects us is water, and the idea of the canoe is knowledge as well. And then we brought on Raven Spirit Dance in Vancouver, Michelle Olson, my colleague here, who runs Raven Spirit Dance. And so it became a bigger project. And so we've been developing this work about water. And again, I'm such an apocalyptist. It's about kind of what we're doing to the water and how that affects all of us all over the world. I think it's interesting that Indigenous people all over the globe are working together. And of course, water's the big thing right now. The water keepers, water's the next sort of battleground.
Okay, so some of the fun questions I ask sometimes have to do with water. When was the last time you got to go for a swim in a lake?
Well, it would have been last summer. We camp all the time in Saskatchewan. Oh, and actually, last summer, my partner and I camped down the coast, and then we stayed at Hyatt Lake near Oregon Shakespeare Festival, because I had a gig at Oregon Shakespeare Festival. And so I swam in both the ocean and the lakes.
Beautiful.
Right?
What's your favorite way to ingest maple syrup?
Oh, God, on oats in the morning? Blueberries, steel-cut oats, maple syrup, 5 days a week.
Oh, I love my maple syrup.
I also put maple syrup in my salad dressing, and that happens quite often, too.
Have you ever seen a bear?
I am Bear Clan, Mugwood, yeah. I am Bear Clan, and yes, I see bears all the time.
So I'm seeing a bear is what you're
yes,
saying.
Yes, you are. Both grizzly and black.
Now, I almost forgot about my big money question, and you have an article written on it that I read last night. As a theater artist, how do you make money?
I'm so blessed to finally have arrived at a place where, when I was in university, I was like, someday I just want to be well off enough that I don't have to add up the groceries as I'm buying them. So when I hit that, you know, in my 30s, I'd sort of arrived. I'm lucky now. I do dramaturgy for money. I'm directing. Someone's paying me to direct. I haven't had a day job in a long, long time. I don't have a lot of costs, though. I don't own a house. I don't have kids. I have a partner who right now has a day job. We cobble together a lifestyle. We live pretty frugally. People pay to bring me to places, so I fly around for, you know, on someone else's dime a lot. We pay better in theater than we used to when I started out.
Well, thank you so much for joining me today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening to the Lisa Lafferty Podcast. This was episode 6. To download other conversations in this series with Brad Fraser, Allison Kelly, David J. Diamond, Laurel Thompson, and Simon David, go to citr.ca.